You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 2nd, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
Yes, and it was 12 years ago tomorrow that the James Randi Educational Foundation was officially founded and began by James Randi.
Cool. Excellent.
Really?
Yep. Tomorrow's the birthday.
J-Ref Day.
Happy J-Ref Day.
So it's been 12 years, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's worth celebrating.
As long as we've been around as the Connecticut Skeptical Society and the NES and Skeptics.
That's right.
Guide.
This is our 12th year, too,
as
the
right.
NES.
So we share an anniversary as far as 1996 goes with Randi.
So. That's right. Wow.
Jay is away this week, so he won't be able to join us.
Oh.
And I'm away as well. I'm in California this week filming the this is the first day of shooting for the pilot of The Skeptologists.
Details. Give me details. Come on.
It's a lot of fun. So, you know, it's fun just hanging out with everybody. You know, Phil Plate, Michael Shermer, Yao Man from Survivor. He's actually a really nice guy.
Yao
Man. Bob, you're a big fan of Survivor, right?
Yeah, I seem to get sucked into it every season. Yao Man was great. He was one of the standouts of all seasons. He was just this unassuming guy, skinny guy, yep. kind of geeky looking, I guess, and but very, very personable. Seems like such a nice guy. Super bright. He was making fire before anybody. Very bright guy, and surprisingly, you wouldn't think by looking at him, but he was also kicking butt in the challenges too. So this is a very capable guy and extremely popular guy. So I was psyched.
So does that mean that Steve might be the first one voted off the island? I'm a little worried. He sounds like quite the contender.
Steve, get into an alliance with Yao Man, and you'll be okay.
Okay, yeah. That's good. That's good advice.
So, what are you guys doing?
Today, we did the first day of shooting was just all of the background stuff. So it was just us talking about our bios and answering just questions about like why are we skeptical, that kind of stuff. This is just all filler stuff that they're going to use,
right?
And then doing like the shots for the preview, like for the CG intro to the show. So they have to like. We all have
CG.
To stand there and look skeptical as the camera swings by us, that kind of stuff.
It's always been a challenge for skeptics to look right. skeptical. I mean, how do you look skeptical? That's always been a challenge.
It's like that recent to-do with Jay Leno telling that guy to look in the camera and give his best gay look.
Oh,
it's like you can't do a really good skeptical look without resorting to stereotypes.
Open mouth, right. Insert foot.
I guess the key is just don't look stupid.
That's always the endeavor, is not to look or sound stupid. Right? So hopefully we'll achieve that. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. You know, Brian Dunning of Skeptoid is one of the co-producers with Ryan Johnson. So the whole crew is really good. Everybody seems to be pretty much on board with the whole skeptical thing. So I think it's going well. Tomorrow we're going on some interesting locations, which I'm very excited about, actually. It should be a lot of fun.
I bet it's a strip club.
Oh, just thinking that.
I bet it's Local Sylvia strip Brown's club. Palace of Whoopi.
Those breasts are not real. I must perform an experiment.
Mark, who is the magician on the cast, actually told me a story that he had an encounter with Sylvia Brown before she was famous. She was giving a talk at a hall. And he was, infiltrating the audience just to go there just as a regular guy just to get her shtick. And she canceled at the last minute because she heard there was going to be a skeptic in the audience. So she came up with lame excuse and totally bailed on the people who were producing or promoting the talk.
That's beautiful.
Oh, wow. Nice. She's that afraid.
Well done.
For her, it's just a business for her. She doesn't want... Yeah, she took her. Yeah, she also took her money. She took her money and just made some excuse and never gave the talk.
Whoa!
Of course,
brutal.
Well, it sounds like you guys are having fun bonding.
Yeah. Right now, I actually asked Phil Plate to join us tonight, but he has a date tonight. Phil Plate has a date.
Whoa!
With who? I hope his wife isn't listening.
With Will Wheaton, yes. Phil
Isn't
has a
Will
going to
be at
crush.
And Will's going to be at TAM 6, if I'm not mistaken?
No, apparently Will has a conflict and can't make TAM 6 this year.
Well, he chose poorly. He should have dumped the other thing.
He did, but he's got some prior engagement. But we're working on him for next year. So Phil's having dinner with Will Wheaton you know, who played Wesley Crusher on Star Trek right now.
So maybe, Phil does have a huge man crush on him, so.
I wonder what the replicator is making them for dinner.
Yeah.
I'm sure Phil is too nervous to eat right now. He's just poking at his salad.
Oh, come on. It's Wesley Crusher. I mean, come on.
You don't understand the depths of Phil's crush on Will Wheaton.
Apparently not, and I don't think I want
humorous.
To.
I look forward to the blog post that will surely follow.
Right. Actually, Will Wheaton has a really, really well-written, very rational blog, which is how
he does.
Phil really got interested in it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's got a great
blog. Find out what it's called. And
cool. I got to check that out.
I believe it's like willwheaton.com.
Yeah, it's just Will Wheaton. Just if you look up his name, you'll find it.
I'm sorry. It's willwheaton.net.
Well, let's get to some news items. First, some follow-up on the whole PZ Meyer being expelled from Expelled bit. Now, Rebecca, you were actually involved with a media conference with the producers of Expelled. This is that intelligent design propaganda movie that starring Ben Stein that's coming out. And why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, if anyone in our audience isn't aware of Expelled, you can go to expelledexposed.com and get caught up. That's Eugenie Scott's site that she talked about on the show last week. So the makers of the film, including two producers, Ben Stein and their hired PR goons, they held a teleconference for members of the press, and they sent me an invite. This was just last Friday. They invited me to call in.
How did you get on that invite list, by the way?
I don't know. I just...
I signed up.
I got the email and I just laughed for like 10 minutes.
Right. They failed.
they were full of fail. Like the fail was leaking out of their pores. And of course I immediately forwarded the email to, you know, Jeannie and, PZ and Richard Dawkins and everybody, just in case, you know. So I call in on Friday, and I was a little disappointed at first because the PR goons came on and said, thanks for everybody who's calling in right now to listen. Just so you know, we're taking questions by email, and then we'll read the questions to the producers and Ben Stein, and they will then answer them. So immediately you know that they're going to filter out anything messy, you know, anything too hard, and probably just lob a couple of softballs. So I go back to my desk and I send an email with some questions that I hope will maybe make it past, like just asking Ben Stein to explain creationism, and explain what he, believes the definition of evolution to be, because I think that he really has no idea. So I thought that maybe there stood a chance of getting through. I go back and I check in on the conference call every now and again, but I'm at work, so I can't really listen the whole time. And it's pretty much your standard just BS. They're talking about basically how great they are, much patting on the back. It was really kind of sickening. They did bring up the whole incident with kicking out PZ Myers in Minneapolis when they showed their film 2 weeks ago. It was just so full of their stupid lies that it was really difficult to listen to. It was, you know, PZ was causing a disturbance and, or let's see, what did they go with? Oh, I think they said that, you know, they knew Richard Dawkins was there, but they wanted to let him in, as opposed to the fact that they had no clue he was there.
And right.
Broke into the call? Can you explain that, Rebecca?
I can indeed. You see, apparently PZ tuned in early. He called in a little bit early and listened to the producers talking and the PR guys, and they openly said what the code was to get in and have the ability to speak on the phone call. While all the journalists could only hear, this code would allow you to speak. So PZ hung up the phone and called right back and had speaking privileges. But then he just kept mute until he just couldn't take it anymore, and then he burst in. And nice. Normally I would be really upset for missing that, but the fact of the matter is that I had happened to have been recording the entire thing. So wow. Lucky for me, and also lucky for all of our friends online, I actually have audio of the producers being just completely blown away. They start to move on to another topic. PZ comes in and says, you know, let's not move on. Let's not, because I'd prefer to keep talking about this. And there's this awkward pause, and somebody says, wait, who's speaking? And he goes, this is PZ Myers. Like, it's the most natural thing on the world. And I kind of fell in love with him a little bit right then.
Can you imagine the look on their faces hearing his voice come through?
They went nuts. Like, to hear them
scramble.
Like, there's nervous laughter. There's scrambling. It's really quite
hilarious.
A thing to hear. So, if you guys are interested in hearing it, you can go on Skeptic. And so, you know, the quality is a little rough, but we have a little clip here that we can play now. And if you want to hear the rest of it and see a transcript, just go on the Skeptic blog and do a search for PZ, and you will find it.
Gentlemen, let's move off of those controversies and back to really the core message of the film. I understand.
Let's not move off of it. You do know that both Richard Dawkins and P.G. Myers have posted substantial criticisms of your movies, don't you?
Well, I haven't seen them, but why don't you tell us what they are?
Yeah. Who's asking that question? This is P.G. Myers.
Oh, well, wonderful.
You are very persistent in this. Well, I mean, they're ignoring the substantial criticisms that have been made of the
film. Well, were you involved?
Bring it to conference.
Is this another case of you sort of...
PZ, Mr. Myers, I would like to hear the criticisms.
Well, that the idea that Nazism is derived from evolutionary theory is completely bogus.
Well, PZ, you must not have been on the phone call very long, because we've already talked about that.
Yes, I heard a bunch of lies about that.
Oh, more lies. Okay. Yes. Well, maybe high differences of opinion.
How do you credit the fact that anti-Semitism has a long history in Germany?
Okay.
You know, before Martin
Luther,
this was out there.
Well, I would say that having anti-Semitism out there is much different than a situation where you have a systematic extermination of a race. These are two different things. It's a much more advanced version of it, and you have to have a Darwinian.
Have you ever heard of a pogrom? Those have been going on for centuries.
We've seen millions of people exterminated from the Jewish race for centuries?
Well, you have seen many Jewish people exterminated for centuries. You are trivializing all men to blame it on Darwin.
Hey, Paul, it's
Walt and Ben here. We're going to be moving on to our next interview.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
Okay.
In other words, you're going to run away from substantial criticisms of your film.
No, Mr. Myers, excuse me, I'm the moderator of this call. Mr. Myers, as you've done previously with trying to sneak into the film, you have come uninvited to this call, okay, and I'm going to ask you to do the honorable thing, and you can feel free to listen in, and if we have a question for you, we will direct that question to you, but otherwise...
Yes, you'll ask me to do the honorable thing, while you do the dishonorable thing, and continue our policy of lies.
When you have your own conference call, which you are in charge of, you may do whatever you wish, but this call is our call, okay?
Uh-huh.
You are not invited right now, and I'm making that clear to everybody who's listening, okay? You're demonstrating your tactics by speaking in on a call that you are not invited to speak on. So I'm going to ask you to remain on the sideline.
Yes.
So I have
I'm going to sign off now, but I will invite any press listening to contact me at pzmyers@gmail.com. I'm happy to talk to you about the falsehoods that are being propagated in this film and that are being propagated in this interview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's great. That's too bad. I wanted to knock them down one by one. I don't know what... If we if we have a question for PZ, we can invite him back on and he can answer the question. I want to move to a topic that I think is very, very interesting, and that is the impact of...
Yeah. The transcript is interesting because, like, Mark Mathis, yeah. who is the producer, was saying to PZ, bring it. Like, let's go ahead. Send me your questions. Let's go at it. But then they kicked PZ off. And he's like, oh, that's too bad. I really wanted to address his issues. Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. It was pure passive aggressive.
It was just all posturing. So, ironically, they were accusing PZ of crashing the Expelled movie a couple weeks ago, which was a lie. But now this time he really did crash their press conference. He really did.
Yeah. In all honesty, yeah. And it was hilarious.
But it was hilarious, right? And again, just because they're incompetent, you know, they're...
Completely incompetent.
Here's the secret code so you could talk while it's possible that somebody could be listening in and they didn't even consider that possibility.
Also, usually when somebody joins a conference like that, normally, I guess they had it turned off, normally you're announced, you know, now being joined by, and then whatever said.
They didn't have that, which confused me at first when I signed on, and then there were these people talking, and I'm like, do I introduce myself? I don't know. And I just decided to keep quiet, and then I found out later that it didn't matter because all of our lines were muted anyway.
Yeah.
And it's all started because inexplicably they invited you to this press conference. Not only the connection.
Yes.
Not being completely – they obviously didn't Google your name or whatever. They didn't spend the time it would take to realize that you're not in their camp.
I don't know.
Yeah, they might know who you are now, though.
I'm wondering if they just were looking for any blog that was mentioning the film, maybe doing a Google and seeing what blogs came up and sending it to them. They also invited a media person from Science Blogs. They didn't, and they invited, I think they sent invites to some of the Panda's Thumb guys too, but they did not send an invite to PZ. Mm-hmm. So they did send some, like I wasn't the only enemy that they invited. So yeah, I'm not sure what they were hoping to accomplish by that. If they were trying to rub it in our faces or...
I don't know.
But one other thing, it's baffling.
The last thing I want to say, though, before I go off this topic, is that before PZ got kicked off, he had the chance to tell the media who were there, if you want the real story, here's how to contact me once the conference is over. So
he did, and he did supposedly he got dozens of emails from journalists.
Awesome, awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. Well done.
Nice
job. Good job.
Thank you.
The next news item has to do with creating a human-animal embryo. A British team claims that they have already created human-cow hybrid embryo. The way they accomplish this is by taking a cow stem cell, embryonic stem cell, removing the nucleus, and then injecting the nucleus, which has the DNA, from a human cell. And then you end up with an embryonic stem cell with human DNA, but the rest of the cell bits, including the mitochondria, which has a little bit of its own DNA, would be cow. So it is a cow-human hybrid. The purpose for this is to create embryonic stem cells for research, not to clone people or to use these
therapeutically. Not to make a manimal.
Right, not to make a half cow, half human, but for embryonic stem cells for research, because there is a shortage of such cells, mainly because of the ban in the U.S. But this has created a lot of controversy because, you know, whenever you talk about mixing human and non-human, you know, biological parts, somebody's going to get upset about it. The Roman Catholic Church is not happy with this.
When's the last time they were happy about something that happened in the sciences?
Cardinal Keith O'Brien, who's the head of the Catholic Church in Scotland, described the work as experiments of Frankenstein proportion. So that's the spin they're putting on.
Yeah, what an exact, perfect description of what's going on. He should be a scientist.
Yes. The cow person will definitely storm a village and kill a small child. I just wish Jay were here so that he and I could argue about whether to call it a cow or a person.
Cow man.
But no, but of course, this type of work is not being done. You can't grow these embryos past the 32 cell stage. It's actually against the law. That's the law in the UK.
Right.
What is that equivalent to 32 32 cells, you said?
Yeah, 32 cells. Yeah, 32 cells. So that's still in the right. embryo stage.
Let's say I were pregnant with the manimal. How far along would I be?
32 cells, I think, is just either hours to a day or so. I mean, this is still very, very tiny. You know, I think
still within the Plan B range to get rid of the.
You'd only be kind of pregnant.
This is pre-implantation. This is where it's still traveling down the fallopian tube. It hasn't really implanted.
Not even nidation
in the uterus.
Hasn't attached to the wall.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
Okay.
But what would happen? I mean, it's according to what I read, this is essentially 99.9% of human genetic material with only the mitochondrial DNA. Not being human, but how different is mitochondrial DNA of a cow compared to a human? What would happen if you just kind of really let this go on, prodding it along if you had to? I wonder what would happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it might be perfectly normal, but I don't know.
Perfectly
normal.
It's
possible.
What?
I mean, it might be a perfectly normal human being without any deficit or problem.
Really?
Yeah, I mean it's entirely human DNA in the nucleus. The only thing is that the mitochondria would be partly cow mitochondria. It would be partly human mitochondria, partly cow mitochondria. That could potentially be a problem. It depends on how similar human and cow mitochondria are. Are there any gene incompatibilities there? And I don't know the answer to that question. We may know it, but I don't know it. It's not impossible that it would just be a perfectly normal human being.
Yeah. All right. Let's see.
But that's not going to happen, right? At least no time soon. The next news item. This is a funny one. This is a tantric guru who was called out on live TV. Bob, you prepared this one.
Yeah, this is good. It's a far too rare and wonderful occurrence when a popular piece of the paranormal is put to a definitive test in front of a huge audience, and this is exactly what happened earlier in March on a popular Indian TV show. It all started when Uma Bharati, a former chief minister of the state of Madhya Pradesh, was accused her political opponents of harming her. Apparently, her uncle died, she banged her leg. She woke up with these mysterious wounds and sores on her legs. I have no idea what that's all about. How do you wake up with mysterious wounds?
Maybe she had a seizure.
I guess that's possible.
That's actually, if somebody has a seizure at nighttime, sometimes it's the only way you know is that they wake up with unexplained bruises and injuries on their limbs.
India TV, which in the article I read was described as one of India's major Hindi channels. I don't know if they meant to say shows, so I don't know if it's a channel or a show, invited two people on their show, Sanal Edamaruku, who is president of Rationalist International, and Pandit Surinder Sharma, who claims to be the tantric of top politicians, to discuss tantric power versus science. Now, Tantra, I found a definition of Tantra that described it as an Asian body of beliefs and practices, which, working from the principle that the universe we experience is nothing other than the concrete manifestation of the divine energy of the Godhead that creates and maintains the universe, seeks to ritually appropriate and channel that energy in creative ways. Now, mantras also play an important part of Tantra. You might have heard of mantras. These verbalizations are seen as ways of singing the divine power into being.
I forgot my mantra. Anyone? Anyone know that movie?
Your mantra.
Come on.
Nope. Sorry.
Nope.
I'll leave it to the listeners. Put it on the board.
During the show, the tantric, I'll refer to Pandit Surinder Sharma as the tantric. That's how he's referred to in the articles that I read. The tantric showed a small wheat flour dough figure, kind of like a voodoo doll, on the show. And he claimed that by putting a string around its neck like a noose, he could kill anyone he wanted within 3 minutes using black magic.
Anyone made of dough, at least.
All the Pillsbury people around.
You got it. Sanal, being the good skeptic, of course, challenged him to try and kill him. So Pandit accepted, which was probably his first major mistake of the night. The attempt.
I would say it was at least his second or third.
He made lots of mistakes, but this is the first major one. The attempt to magically kill Sanal started with mantras, as I described earlier, or magic words like Avada Kedavra. Well, no,
Kedavra. What?
That would have worked if he did that one.
That would be silly.
Avada Kedavra. Doesn't he call this the ultimate destruction ceremony?
I'm getting there.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The tantric actually chanted stuff like Om Linga Linga Lina Linga Kili Kili Kili. And of course, as you might expect, nothing happened.
Killy didn't
then
work?
Right. You imagine that's funny how that.
You try murdery.
I wonder if that actually means anything. But he then was getting a little desperate, I think, after a while, and he took out a knife and was waving a knife over Sonal's body. Nothing happened, except I think Sonal started laughing at him. He then started to touch him. He was like putting his hands all over his head and then started squeezing his temples. And Sonal had to remind him that, hey, only black magic. You're not supposed to use physical force to accomplish
it. Yeah, right. Then what?
So,
did he pull out a gun at any point? I would get worried if he pulls out a gun.
So this is so funny. The 3-minute deadline or time frame comes and goes. So then they're at 5 minutes, then a half hour. Then the allotted time for the entire show was over. The show is over, done, but they keep going. They keep going. Finally, 2 hours later, 2 hours after the original 3 minutes, and I'm sure, I don't know, one or two or maybe even three shows miss, weren't going to be on TV that night because this show was still on. Finally, the anchor bravely declares that the tantric failed. So what happens now, skeptics?
Special pleading.
Let the excuses begin.
Yeah, so the tantric, and this guy is just not sophisticated. I don't think he's encountered too many skeptics in his days, but he claims that a very powerful god that Sonal must have worshipped must be protecting him. And I guess he didn't do his homework on Sonal because Sonal said, no, I'm an atheist.
Yay.
So that kind of threw him for a loop,
I
think.
He said, oh, the atheist god is protecting you.
All of them.
Right. So then he pulls out, he pulls out his special card here, and he goes, that he has a never-failing special black magic for ultimate destruction that he could use. But
big +3.
Big caveat. Yeah, it can only be done at night. So, of course, what happens? So now, of course, challenges him for that very night. So he accepted. So they got 3 hours to kill. So India TV announces over and over the Great Tantra Challenge. Tonight, don't miss it. So they're promoting this like for 3 hours, and I think they did a good job because according to the article I read, several hundred million people are watching it that night. That's quite an audience. Cue to that night. So that night, they're ready to go. The tantric pandit Surinder Sharma, he warns Sonal. He says that once the ultimate magic is called upon, there's no turning back. Once it's unleashed, that's it. And he describes what happens. He says that in 2 minutes, Sonal would get crazy. 1 minute later, he'll scream in pain and die. So Sonal, of course, starts laughing.
Wait, I'm sorry. Wait, did you say laughing or screaming in pain?
It was hard to tell. He was laughing so hard.
Yeah. Following describes the process of experts invoking ultimate death magic. Please do try this at home. First, chant death words like Om Linga Linga Lina Linga Killy Killy.
Killy Killy Killy.
Right. Then throw magic ingredients into a fire to make cool colors. Ooh. Next, touch the person you want dead, even if you're warned to keep your distance over and over. Then write the name of your victim on paper, tear it up, and put the pieces into boiling butter oil. Margarine's okay as long as it has trans fat.
What about I can't believe it's not Butter Light? Is that okay?
No, that won't work. That totally reverses the spell.
All right, and when do we eat the paper with the butter? Come on.
Well, you don't eat it. You dramatically throw the paper in the fire.
What a waste.
And then this is key. Do not act surprised when nothing happens.
Act cool, man. Act cool.
Bring out your trusty flour dough, and you knead it carefully and powder it with mysterious ingredients.
Oh, drop it in the butter. I like where this is going. It's going somewhere delicious.
Then have your victim touch it before piercing it with blunt nails. They have to be blunt.
What about a fork?
No.
That won't work. Not unless you break off the tines. Finally, hey, we're getting to the end here. Finally, cut the dough wildly with a knife and throw it all into the fire. And you know you're done when your victim starts laughing again.
Or when the pancakes have nicely browned on both sides.
We will post this recipe on the website.
And there you go. This feeds, kills 8.
Nice.
So apparently they had a scientist on the show, and he said that he wasn't identified or what his specialty was, but he did say the following. He said, tantrics are creating such a scaring atmosphere that even people who know that black magic has no base can just break down out of fear. It needs enormous courage and confidence to challenge them by actually putting one's life at risk, he said. By doing so, Sonal Edamaruku has broken the spell and has taken away much of the fear of those who witnessed his triumph.
Well done, Sunal.
Congratulations to you, Sunal. You did a great job.
Now, here's the flip side of that, guys. In all seriousness, and you can call this the James Randi psychic healing effect. Remember when Randi was on the Carson show? He did the psychic healing. He pulled the tumors out of the guy. It was all a trick and so forth. And then they reported that after the show, everyone was calling up to find out how they could get in touch with a psychic surgeon. So it kind of had this almost a boomerang or backfire effect. Do you think that's going to happen in this case as well?
Not so much because when he did the demonstration, he made it look good. It made it look like he was really doing something. Here, they just failed over and over and over, and there was no success.
But we've seen time again that evidence doesn't convince people of anything. They just want a show. They just want a flashy person that they can pour their money and belief into.
But this isn't a scientific evidence-based thing. This is an emotional thing where people tuning in can clearly see a man laughing at something that was previously considered very disturbing and dark. And I think that can have a huge impact on changing the whole attitude of how this culture is viewing this particular exercise.
Right.
So, I think it's different. I think it's a very different situation.
Yeah,
we'll see. I mean, it's nice. It's just good to see somebody stand up to that in public, meet the challenge, and of course it all goes as we expect. What the effect will be on the culture.
Right.
No one thing is going to turn around that much culture or embedded beliefs, but everything helps. And you can only applaud something like this happening.
And so that huge audience, hundreds of millions of people, I mean, how often does that happen? That is a very rare event.
In a country of a billion people? Yeah.
I don't know. Well, thanks, Bob. The next news item has to do with the CERN Super Collider. This is actually the Large Hadron Collider, which has been being built over the last 14 years at a cost of $8 billion. And this is being produced by the European Center for Nuclear Research, or CERN, C-E-R-N. The scientists hope to use this to recreate particles that may have existed a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. So this is pretty exciting science. But of course, there's got to be some nutball in there trying to ruin everybody's fun, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
Former nuclear safety officer Walter Wagner. That surprised me because in a lot of the articles I read said that this guy was a botanist or something. But he's a nuclear safety officer. And Louis Sancho, both living in Hawaii. And Sancho, I could find very little about this guy. All I could find was that he's from Spain, and according to Phil, he's a whack job. I did look at a website that he was involved in that seems pretty far gone. But they both have asked for injunctions to prevent CERN from booting up the Large Hadron Collider, which is scheduled to start later this year. Their big claim is that CERN has underplayed the likelihood of a planetary apocalypse that might be caused by the LHC. And Steve described the LHC and some of the things that they hope to accomplish with it. Their fear now, the big fear is that the LHC will create an Earth-devouring black hole, or that it could also create strange matter in the form of something called strangelets that could transform our planet into a small, dense ball of strange matter. Now, a spokesman from CERN said the lawsuit claims were complete nonsense. Much higher energy collisions than those at the LHC occur in nature all the time because cosmic ray particles zip around our galaxy at close to the speed of light. He said that the moon has undergone such collisions for 5 billion years without being devoured by a ravenous black hole or killer strangelet. Now, regarding the black holes, research that CERN had done relatively recently has shown that there won't be enough energy to create a black hole. Even if they were created, they would immediately disappear in a puff of Hawking radiation in about 10 to the minus 42 seconds, which is a pretty small amount of time. Now, Wagner and Sancho claim that there's no absolute proof of Hawking radiation. And regarding this point, Phil of badastronomy.com, Phil makes a great point when he says in his blog that the same equations in quantum mechanics that say that subatomic collisions could create black holes also say that they will evaporate. So it's pretty much a package deal. You can't say, one's not going to happen, but the other one is. They pretty much go together. So that's kind of silly. Now, regarding strangelets, theoretically, these are, and I stress the word theoretically, these are negatively charged strangelets that are certain exotic yet stable combinations of quarks, which are the constituents of protons and neutrons, and which are governed by the color force. Now, this material could potentially have a Midas-like ability to change everything it comes in contact with into hyperdense, strange matter. The Earth would collapse down to about a 100-meter sphere if this, in fact, could occur. Now, physicist and author Michio Kaku has said regarding this that we see no evidence of this bizarre theory. He said, once in a while, we trot it out to scare the pants off people, but it's not serious. The general consensus regarding these, I believe, is that strangelets are almost certainly not stable. Even if they are, they would not be produced at the LHC. And even if they are produced there, they would almost definitely have a positive charge and be screened from any interactions by a cloud of electrons. So every one of these steps in the argument would have to be flawed for there to be a risk of these strangelets converting the Earth into strange matter. So this is exceedingly unlikely, and these guys have latched onto this as
inevitable,
you know, as something just fear-mongering. And I mean, maybe, you know, maybe they actually have a real fear of this, and they think that it should be researched more thoroughly. What does it feel like to actually feel like you could be potentially saving the planet? You know, these guys must think, if they believe this, and I'm sure they have a genuine desire to prevent this stuff from happening, and they really think it could happen. I don't know, what does it feel like to think that, wow, I could be saving, if they listen to me, I could be saving the planet, or even the universe, because some of these predictions can say that some of these changes could actually affect the entire universe itself. So,
well, yeah, I mean, it's like you're Spider-Man and
right?
The bad guy as the scientist who is, you know, out of control, you know. And speaking of, I want to have a comic book one day, and I want the villain to be Professor Strangelet, and he will be all about making this come to pass. That will be his main goal.
He's going to invent a race of cowmen to take over the world.
So, Bob, I think that you're
brilliant.
You're partly right, but I also think they're just grandstanding. It's easy to say, "Oh, this isn't safe," you know, to be the Cassandra and to fearmonger like that, and to say that they haven't proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that this horrible thing can't happen. That's easy. I think they're just grandstanding. This guy Luis Sancho, if you go to his website, it pulls up actually a PDF file, and it's totally Looney Tunes. This guy is into the quantic networks of energy and information with super organisms.
Nice.
It is complete
quantic.
And total
super organisms like a manimal.
it's just science babble. It's just techno babble nonsense. I mean, just take a look at it. This is like all one notch shy of Time Cube. Seriously, it's that bad. So this guy's
Ooh.
A total nut job. And
that's
then
harsh.
The other guy, Walter Wagner, this is not the first time he sued to prevent
no.
a superclider from being turned on, right, Bob?
Yep. The RHIC, he made similar claims.
And that worked, that was fine.
Yeah, it's been going for years. It's been going for years. So yeah, he does this every time a collider's gonna come online.
Right.
So
everybody needs a hobby.
Right, it's his hobby
yeah.
to prevent super colliders from coming online.
Honey, come to bed. I can't. There's another collider about to start up.
Well, thanks, Bob. Let's go on to your questions and emails. First one comes from Edgar Alfonso Polanco from Colombia. And Edgar writes, "Hello, skeptics. I'm 24, and I'm
Hello,
writing
Edgar.
You all the way from Bogota, Colombia. I've been listening to you for a while now. As a matter of fact, the first episode I listened to was the one where you announced Perry's death. Well, I'm an economist, and I used to believe really weird stuff, UFOs, ESP, reincarnation, you name it. Thanks to people like you, James Randi, Richard Dawkins, and a lot more, I am now a proud skeptic. Browsing over the internet, I found this page. It has a long list of arguments skeptics made when debunking something. Some I can think of an answer to, but for some, like number 5, the answer eludes me. I know the time in your show is short, and maybe you can go over the whole list, but I think this would make a nice name, not logical fallacy." Well, so do we, Edgar, so thanks for sending us in. This is the website called Debunking Skeptical Arguments, and this is written by a man named, ironically, Winston Wu.
Oh, yeah. Those of you who have been on the JREF forum for a few years remember him. He's quite infamous with lawsuits in the JREF and Yeah,
lawsuit.
It's a walking mess.
Right, mm-hmm. right. But he took the time to write a rather elaborate website with these long responses to typical skeptical arguments. He fancies himself as a debunker of the skeptical debunkers. And, of course, he gets it all wrong. I mean, his thinking is so hopelessly confused. And if he was a frequent denizen of the JREF forums, apparently he hasn't learned anything from that experience except how to parrot some skeptical jargon, but only enough to use it to create a straw man that he could then attack. So let's take a couple of these. We'll start with the first one. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. That's something that that skeptics mm-hmm. say a lot. What it basically means, T.H. Huxley said a similar thing. Huxley, who was Darwin's bulldog, you know, a brilliant man, said that a wise man apportions his belief to the evidence. It's basically the same concept. Any belief should be matched by an equal amount of evidence. And if something is extraordinary, meaning that based upon everything we know up to this point, this claim is unlikely. It either would require new assumptions about the world or the universe, or it would overturn previously reasonably established beliefs. Something makes it an unlikely or improbable or extraordinary claim. Therefore, the amount of evidence that would be required to support that, it's got to be equal to the evidence that makes it improbable or unlikely. That, you know, is a pretty logically unassailable statement. I mean, how could you argue with that? But this is what he has to say about it. He has his seven problems with that position, although he skipped over number two for some reason. First of all, he says that skeptics do not define what we mean by extraordinary, referring to the amount of evidence that would be required. And therefore, we could use that to move the goalposts. That statement is certainly potentially true, but what he's then saying is that all skeptics are deniers, because that is a tactic of denial, is to use the this is a straw man, because he's assuming that the only way to apply this principle is to abuse it, and that it can't be properly applied. But he did not establish or make the case that you could not reasonably apply the principle of extraordinary evidence. So in that way, he constructs this straw man, which is really just characterizing all skepticism as denial. And that is the basic strategy that he follows. He twists everything enough to make it into this straw man, which he then tears down. There's too much here to go over all of this during this podcast, so I'm going to pick out just some representative pieces. Another one is number four, his problem with this skeptical premise is that he says that it's based upon an unproven premise that paranormal phenomena are impossible or extremely improbable. And then he goes on to attack the notion that it's impossible. He really focuses on that. So again, that's another straw man. None of this is premised, first of all, on the belief that paranormal claims, which is what he's interested in defending, are impossible. One application of this principle, and this doesn't really get to the logical validity of the principle, just this application of it, is that paranormal claims are inherently improbable. And yeah, I think that that's been established. That's established just by the fact that no one's proven any paranormal claim. So if something is unproven, by definition, that would require a new assumption about the universe, and that is enough to make something inherently improbable, or at least require, you know, a sufficient amount of evidence to establish it as a new phenomenon. But let's go to number five, which is the one that that Edgar specifically mentioned. The anecdotal evidence is invalid argument. This is an important one because believers in all kinds of nonsense would like to rely and heavily do rely upon anecdotal evidence, and scientists and skeptics generally do not accept anecdotal evidence as reliable. And he's saying that this is not valid. But his logic here is so twisted. First, let me just say why I think the principle is valid. And I actually blogged about this a couple of times on Neurologica and Science-Based Medicine, and I'll have the links to that. Because again, it just needs to be spelled out very specifically why we hold this to be true. It's because there's multiple reasons why anecdotal evidence is unreliable. It's uncontrolled. It relies upon memory, which is flawed in many, many ways. And it's subject to a host of psychological factors that could lead people to arrive at false conclusions. So that's pretty straightforward, and this is not some, you know, bizarre, extreme, hard-nosed, skeptical philosophy as he's trying to portray it. This is just a basic scientific principle. Uncontrolled observations are not objective, sound scientific evidence, period. That is one of the core pieces of wisdom that science has developed, you know, over the last few centuries. Again, what he says, let me pick out a couple of representative arguments that he makes.
Well, Steve, let me throw one in. One quote I have from that was, he says that the fact is that most anecdotes, personal accounts, and what we remember check out most of the time. Yeah. Rarely is it ever based on nothing at all. Now, I see that as a straw man argument. Really, we don't say non-events. We say, no, it's mostly a misinterpretation. So he's mischaracterizing the skeptical argument, I think. It's not, because what he's saying here is that when they hit us with an anecdote, we say, oh, that didn't happen, which we usually, I don't think we say that. Mainly it's like, no, you misinterpreted this, and this is more likely than your, you know, this interpretation is more likely than your interpretation. So I saw that as a straw man, that specific quote.
Right. Here's one. He says, imagining a conversation with a skeptic, he says that skeptics, you know, he'll challenge them, say, well, if you don't believe in anecdotal evidence, why do you believe that France exists if you've never been to France? Which I don't know why it's always France. That's got to be copying, because I've had that exact example.
Because they hate our freedom.
Yeah, it's never Uruguay. You know, for whatever reason, it's always France. But anyway, and he writes, the skeptic will usually reply with, but I can fly to France and verify that it exists. And that answer totally misses the point. So I then counter with the key question, yeah, but until you go to France, do you assume for now that it doesn't exist based on your skeptical philosophy that anecdotal evidence is invalid? That stumps them every time. They never have a response to that one. Mm. Well, here's the response.
Well, I guess France doesn't exist.
You've never been to the sun,
right,
either.
Right. You're right. France doesn't exist.
You win this time, Winston Wu.
So this guy's either never actually talked to skeptics, which we know is not true, or he's not listening. So here's the thing. First of all, there's actually pretty extraordinary objective physical evidence that France exists, even without going there. Video, pictures. These are objective pieces of evidence. In fact, if you look at it this way, the alternate hypothesis that France doesn't exist is orders of magnitude more extraordinary than the hypothesis that France does exist, right? Because the alternate hypothesis is that there is an entire culture and language and history that must be made up if France doesn't exist. Every picture I've ever seen of the Eiffel Tower and film must be fabricated or false or misinterpreted or whatever. I mean, it becomes completely impossible, you know, for the notion that France doesn't exist. So it's not based upon just anecdotal evidence, the same kind of anecdotal evidence that people are putting forward to support notions like ghosts exist or that homeopathy works, right? So there's absolutely no analogy there whatsoever, yet he's convinced that he's got the answer that stumps all the skeptics. It's really quite pathetic, actually. He also says, again, this is a straw man, that anecdotal is not considered zero evidence or worthless by our society. So, well, that's an argument ad populi. But it's also a straw man in that the point is not that anecdotal evidence has zero value. I think the best way to regard anecdotal evidence is that it's very, very low-grade evidence. So that it may be sufficient for you to accept really mundane claims.
Right, that's right. The point, is that these are not extraordinary claims that anecdotal evidence can accurately depict.
Right.
It's the extraordinary claims that it never, never can get
like
right.
The everyday little things, you know, that we don't question every little thing that we encounter in our lives. But even for scientific evidence, it's not considered having zero value. Anecdotal evidence is considered sufficient to generate hypotheses, but it's not considered sufficient to test hypotheses, Right. So in other words, if people claim that a treatment worked for them, that's not enough to conclude that it actually does work. But it may be enough to say, all right, so we can generate a hypothesis that maybe this is having some effect. That should be tested. But people confuse that. They think that it's this false dichotomy or this straw man, that it's either it's rock-solid evidence we can use to draw conclusions, or it's worthless and has zero value. No, it's just got to be put into its proper place. It's good for really simple, mundane claims, and it's maybe good for generating hypotheses, but it's not sufficient to establish a completely new phenomenon of reality.
Yeah, or to determine if something's curing cancer or not.
Right, right. So I've actually blogged about a few of these. He has a ton of arguments, where they have like 30 listed here. Some we've heard before, like the James Randi, talks about the James Randi $1 million psychic challenge, but of course, you know, he's full of misinformation when it comes to that. He dismisses our explanations for so-called precognitive dreams and near-death experiences. But it's all, again, these very, very logically challenged, low-grade arguments that he's making. And again, I've written about four or five of them on my blog, actually, about a year ago. This thing has been up there for a while. But it's a good exercise because, first of all, you know, it's good just to talk about the you know, different logical and skeptical principles, and also to understand what the other side is saying about them and why that's wrong. The next email comes from David Gann in Japan, and David writes, "Hi, I'm a great fan of the podcast. Keep up the good work. I wrote before on this matter but never got a reply. Well, I wish we had the time to reply to every single email, and as we said before, we actually do read every single email, although we can't always we don't always have time to reply to all of them, and we apologize for that." But David goes on, "But I know you guys are pretty busy. Please write back if you can. I'm a university teacher in Japan, and some time ago I told my class that some of the dust on the moon had been found to contain dinosaur bone fragments, or dust from fossils that had been blown into the atmosphere during the KT event. I heard this on a reputable podcast like Science Friday or Scientific American, but when I tried to find info on the net, I found nothing. I wrote to both of these podcasts but never heard back from them. I felt bad later because, despite my interest in skepticism, I had passed along something to my class that I later could not verify. Please tell me if you have ever heard of this." Your avid listener, David Gann. Thanks for the question. You know, I searched for this quite extensively, and again, it's always hard to prove a negative, but I went to those sites. I had never heard about it. It seems very implausible to me, and I just wanted to just make sure, just to see if there's anything written about it, and I just found whatever I could on NASA and astronomical sites about the regolith and the moon dust, and there's the report, the description of the regolith, which is the surface of the moon, the upper layer, which is mostly just, you know, pulverized, you know, dirt and minerals from meteor impacts, it is completely and totally lifeless. There is no existing life, nor any fossils or any evidence or remnants of previous life on the surface of the moon. Now, it's not entirely impossible that an asteroid, you know, would smack into the Earth, kick up rocks, which would then escape the Earth's gravity, and then would find themselves on other bodies in the solar system. That happens. So there are Earth meteorites on other planets and moons in the solar system, just like the Earth has Mars rocks and moon rocks, things that were kicked up from Mars or kicked up from the moon or other planets and then eventually found their way to the Earth. And then, you know, we find a meteorite in Antarctica and it's a Mars rock, right? So that happens. And just like, as you remember, like a few years ago, there was the controversy about whether or not a Mars rock collected from a meteorite might have had signs of ancient fossilized
Martian life.
Bacteria or, you know, or microscopic life. So it's not impossible that that could have happened in reverse. However, it would be extremely improbable that an actual, you know, recognizable dinosaur fossil would have found its way to the moon. And it would be then doubly improbable that we would find it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that our sampling of the surface of the moon is very, very tiny. You know, just the Apollo missions and other missions, robotic missions that have brought back moon rocks. The chance of us finding an Earth meteorite and an Earth meteorite with a dinosaur bone in it is infinitesimal. And I would think it would be huge news. So I think the fact that I cannot find any information about that in fact, specific descriptions of the moon, saying that no fossils or anything have ever been discovered there, you know, indicates that that's never happened. So
that's one of those things that just seems to me that we would have heard about.
Yeah.
You know, considering what we do and what our interests are, I think you could almost say, you know, since none of us have heard about that, that just, it really increases my confidence that it never happened.
Right.
You know, and normally you should never do that, because you should actively search for something if you're trying to find an answer. But that, I didn't have time to really look into this news item. But my first thought was that, man, we would have heard about this.
Yeah.
How could that?
How many times have we said
notice?
That on Science or Fiction and gotten way wrong?
Yeah, but usually that's because I'm pulling something off the news wire from an hour ago. You know, that's
right
when you guys haven't heard about it. This is something that, you know, I would have run across. But again, Bob, I did do a search and I could not come up with anything about it. And NASA has nothing to say about it. And you'd think they would.
It would mention it.
That would be a huge story.
But if anyone does think they have any link or any information about this, send it to us. We'll be happy to take a look at it. I just could not quote unquote dig anything up.
Huh.
Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are real and one is fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. However, this week, since I am busy filming the pilot for The Skeptologists, Bob is filling in, just like he did a few weeks ago when I was on vacation. Mm-hmm. So, Bob, take it away.
Very exciting.
All right. The theme this week is science or fiction. Number one.
The theme is things Bob knows. Things Bob knows.
Okay. Numero uno. Study shows male peacock feathers fail to impress females. Peahens, by the way. Number two. Not sure about the pronunciation of this. Tuatara reptile is declared the slowest evolving animal. Number three. Exposure to radon gas can reduce the risk of lung cancer by as much as 60%. Evan, speak to me.
Male peacock's feathers fail to impress females. I mean, that's entirely plausible. It just contradicts sort of the common folk knowledge of that the male feathers is, in fact, what attracts the females. So it's plausible. Tuatara, am I pronouncing that right?
Tuatara.
Tuatara reptile declared the slowest evolving animal. Gosh. I imagine they can measure that, because I think they can make measurements of how specific animals and creatures and things do evolve over time. So I think that's plausible. Exposure to radon gas can reduce the risk of lung cancer by as much as 60%. Ouch. Oh, God. How can you say that that's right? That's just totally counterintuitive. But this is a good one, Bob. I think maybe that's the curveball. But, well, because I probably know the least about it, I'll say that the reptile, slowest evolving animal, that one is fiction.
Rebecca.
Well, peacock feathers, they always seemed a bit metrosexual to me, so I can see how that might not impress their females. Radon, that makes sense. I take my radon pills every day, and I've never had cancer. So I think that's true. And everybody knows that the slowest evolving animal is Tom Cruise. So I believe that that one is fiction.
Steve.
Well, I have to disagree with both of my esteemed colleagues on this one. I think that the Tuatara reptile is the slowest evolving animal. I think that one is actually correct. So for me, it's down to one in three. Both are implausible. I mean, the whole point of male peacock feathers is to attract the female. It's the classic example of sexual selection. So there's got to be something about that you're not telling us in some particular way or something. There's just some study that goes against that belief in some way, but I can't imagine that it would invalidate the entire notion that the purpose of those feathers is for sexual selection. And then the third one, I have not heard anything about this. I mean, it's counterintuitive. I thought the whole point of radon gas was that it was a risk factor. that it was unhealthy, not that it, and that it would reduce the risk of lung cancer by 60%. That's a lot. That's a, you know, that's a big decrease in lung cancer. I wonder if that, can you give me any more information, Bob? Is that just in a subpopulation, like just among smokers or something?
Don't give him more information.
You get nothing in life.
Shut up, Steve. Come on, you got your information.
two words.
That's not the way it works.
Two words. Eat me.
Nice.
I had to ask, all right?
Suck it, Steve.
All right, I'm going to go with the peacocks. I think that one's the fake.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
So, Steve think it's number one, that the peacock feather one, and Rebecca and Evan think it's the tuatara, number two.
Right.
So let's start with number three, shall we? Okay,
we
number
shall.
Three, exposure to levels of radon gas reduces the risk of lung cancer by as much as 60%. That is science.
Wow.
Ooh.
This is a study published in the March issue of the Journal of Health Physics. One thing I kind of removed from that title was low levels.
Low and, levels of radon gas.
It was. But even that, you would think, I think, would have given you pause.
Homeopathic levels?
Not that low.
You know, check. Well, yeah. Wait. Let's run with that. Because this is what struck me when I read about this. It said this was the first study to observe a statistically significant hormetic effect of low level radon exposure. Now, toxins and other environmental stressors, including radiation, that have a beneficial effect at very low doses are said to exhibit hormesis.
Hormesis.
Yeah, that sounds better. Hormesis. Scientists believe that the low doses of toxin may stimulate repair mechanisms in cells. So we'll put a link to that. Now that, man, what do you think of when you read that? Bam, homeopathy.
Yeah, although,
and I never heard of that effect. And I'm just surprised that homeopaths haven't taken this hormetic effect and just run with it.
Yeah, because you require low levels, not zero levels, which is what you get in homeopathy.
Yeah, not no levels.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's obvious. I just seem to think though that they would just take that and still run with that. But so it was low levels. They have to be low levels, of course. But still, 60%. That was quite impressive. Let's see. We shall now go to maybe. Let's try one. Male peacock feathers fail to impress females. According to a study, science.
Wow.
This is science.
Oh,
the discovery.
Again, I say, suck it, Steve.
Yes, now, Steve. That was the classic. That is the classic example of sexual selection, and that's a one thing that really makes it striking. So let me give you some details about this. The discovery made by Mariko Takahashi, a researcher in the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at the University of Tokyo, shatters a long-held belief that male peacock feathers evolved in response to female mate choice. The researchers studied a free-ranging population of Indian peafowl and found that male vocalizations appear to do a better job of grabbing female attention than their visually screaming attire. I also have some extra stuff here saying that that was interesting. Peacock trains, I guess they call them trains. Peacock trains are controlled by the female hormone estrogen rather than testosterone. It is the absence of estrogen in the male that produces the train rather than the presence of testosterone. Traits under the control of estrogen are usually very poor indicators of phenotypic and genotypic condition. So that's what I have on that. Now, the article also did say that this is going to be very controversial.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't necessarily wipe out the whole idea that they evolved through sexual selection.
This is going to rock the peacockology world.
You got
world.
It.
So it's their voice, the sound that they make is a
peacock
so,
monthly.
Is a better, but, is more attractive to the female than the feathers.
Yeah, there's also some talk in the article about these. What do they refer to them as? The shaking. The peacocks would shiver. I think they call them shiver a bit when the peahens would walk around them, and the shivering produce a type of noise that may perhaps the peahen found appealing, or I'm not sure what kind of effect it would have, but just the noise of the feathers kind of moving together. But still, that's not a visual thing. So this might evolve and this might be struck down at some point, but this is what this one study did show. So number two, that means number two, Tuatara Reptile declared the slowest evolving animal is fiction. Congratulations, Evan and Rebecca. Actually, the Tuatara...
Was I right? Was it Tom Cruise?
Tom Cruise was not mentioned in the article, but they did say that the Tuatara is actually the fastest evolving animal. So I just did a complete reversal of that. It said that although these reptiles have remained largely physically unchanged during very long periods of evolution, the researchers found the animals are evolving at a DNA level faster than any other animal. When David Lambert of the Alan Wilson Center, Massey University, analyzed mitochondrial DNA sequences from 650 to 8,000-year-old Tuatara remains and compared them with those of living specimens, they found that the reptile is evolving almost 10 times as fast as the average animal.
Incredible.
Wow. Good for it.
So.
You go, Tuatara.
Una Matata.
Crap, because I read that study and I remembered it wrong.
Oh, Steve.
Yeah, don't you hate that?
That's
welcome
why,
to my world.
So, okay, I know that one's right, so I had to choose between the other two. But I don't know why I remember that one other way as being... Maybe because I was thinking they are the... morphologically, they have been very stable over a very long time. In fact, they are the only reptile in their order. They're in their own order. By themselves.
Right.
That's right.
Wow, it's amazing how much you know about them.
I know. You would think I would have gotten that one right.
Amazing how you didn't get that right.
The reason you failed to remember is because you didn't take your ginkgo biloba. Duh.
And also, I've heard that memories are fallible.
That's true.
You know, I've heard that.
Steve, join the club. Sometimes having a little knowledge is a bad thing.
Go ignorance.
You can't, you know. Well, good job, guys.
Thank you.
Well done, Bob.
I am out of here.
Good job, Bob.
Damn, that takes a long time. Steve, Jesus.
The prep work?
Christ. You got to find, you know, you try to find just the right one, you know, ones that don't sound plausible, and then you got to find one that sounds plausible so that you could reverse it to make it sound implausible like the other two, and it just takes forever. Oh, well.
It's a hard knock life.
Yep.
Evan, do you have a quote for us this week?
I like the Hippocrates one. There are, in fact, two things, science and opinion. The former begets knowledge, the latter ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Spoken by Hippocrates. Many, many...
It's my opinion that was awesome.
Many, many moons ago.
I think it's pronounced Hippocrates.
Hippocrates, yes.
I believe it is Hippocrates.
In Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, I think, right?
Or Jay's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah. Jay's Excellent Adventure. Jay will be back next week.
That was so great.
Good.
He will.
Plato.
He's not quitting like Rebecca?
It's tough being the only funny one.
If there was any confusion based upon Rebecca's blog yesterday, Rebecca announced that she was leaving the SGU
Suckers.
To go to the Mysterious Universe podcast. Of course, that blog was posted on April 1st.
Man, talk about science or fiction.
Right. That combined with the fact that she's happily on our podcast this week should be enough to explain what went on there.
I wouldn't say happily, but I'm here.
Grumpily.
Hey.
Rebecca's grumpily on the podcast.
Only because Bob tripled my salary.
Tripled.
Tripled.
Good work, Bob. Well, thanks for joining me, guys.
Thanks,
Thank
Doctor.
You, Steve.
Thanks for taking up the slack
this episode.
Week. Yep, it's a good episode. Thanks for the guys did extra work this week because I'm busy here in California.
It was Bob. Bob picked up the slack. Well done, Bob.
It was pretty much all Bob.
Good job, Bob.
And Steve, good luck with the rest of your trip
thank
in California.
You, thank you.
Yeah.
Can't wait to hear the report next week when it's all
I will.
Done.
Yeah, I want a full
Got a
report.
A few more days of shooting ahead of us, but it's going to be fun, and I'll give you guys the full report next week.
Cool.
And tell Yao I said hi.
Yeah, I will tell everyone we said hi, please. We're admirers of all of them.
I will pass it along.
I have to say that Ashley, my 10-year-old daughter, was so excited to hear that Yao Man might be on the podcast. I thought we might get him in tonight, but it didn't work out. And she promised me to wake her up if he actually was on it. So give Yao Man a hello from
Ashley. We will get all of the people on the podcast, you know, over the next few months.
Oh, yeah.
I'm working off my laptop from the hotel room, and it just was not technically possible to have someone else on this week. But we'll get them all on over the coming months.
Awesome.
So, good night, guys. Thanks again. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.